Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know how we say sometimes in business, it's all about the brand? Applies in politics too, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 13th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Donald Trump ran for president, and he got, in those early days, a whole lot of traction entirely on the strength of his brand. His name, his brand, is everywhere, so there was always some downside risk, depending on how his campaign went. Since that tape came out last Friday, and in the past 24 hours, that risk has accelerated sharply. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Donald Trump is a walking, talking human brand. When he sneezes, the brand catches a cold. Robert Pasikoff is president of the research firm Brand Keys. He can pinpoint to exactly when the Trump brand started to suffer.
The minute he became the designated candidate for the GOP, that was when the real damage began.
And more consumers started taking seriously Trump's comments about Muslims, Mexicans, and now women. Pasikoff's firm measures added value, that is, how much more you can charge for a product because of the Trump brand. He says stores used to sell a Trump dress shirt for $80. Now,
they might have to reduce the price to $65.
And it's not just shirts. People pay Trump a licensing fee to put his name on all kinds of things, like suits and watches. Trump hotels will suffer too, says Richard Swain, director of brand experience at the firm Huge. He says convention organizers might ask, do I really want to be in a Trump hotel?
What does that make me look like in front of my friends, or make my company look like in front of our clients?
Then again, other marketing experts say the Trump brand is just transitioning. Jonathan Salem Baskin is president of Arcadia Communications Lab. He says Trump has a core group of very committed supporters who will still buy his stuff.
So his clothing line, his Trump University, these are all things that are in fact targeted at people who dream of being well off.
Salem Baskin says all brands have to change, and the Trump brand is just evolving in a very surprising way. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Even though CEO John Stumpf is now gone, the troubles at Wells Fargo are most definitely not. The bank's earnings come out tomorrow, and it's still the subject of criminal probes and boycotts. It's also facing at least two class action lawsuits from workers who say they were fired, not for participating in the fake account scandal, but for refusing to. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has more on that.
When Claudia Ponce de Leon started working for Wells Fargo in 2000, she was 22, and she was good at it.
I was a teller, then I became a customer service representative, a banker, an assistant manager, a manager.
By 2011, she was managing a branch in Pomona, California. There were these intense daily quotas for opening accounts and lines of credit, and she noticed one of her staff tricking customers to make them think they had to get new accounts. So she reported that person to her managers, HR, and the ethics hotline.
I thought I was doing the right thing.
Within a month, she, Claudia, was fired for reasons she says were made up. And since then, lots of stories have come out alleging this kind of retaliation. Claudia's not surprised by that.
A lot of people knew, but just it turned the other way because at the end of the day, everyone gets an incentive.
Those incentives were key. Bankers and their managers were rewarded for high sales numbers. Attorney Jonathan Delshad recently filed a class action lawsuit in California and a federal suit on behalf of employees who say they were fired after refusing to cheat to meet quotas. Many say the people who did cheat were kept on or even promoted. In just the past couple weeks, he says,
over 1,000 former employees have contacted me. Each one of their stories is pretty much cookie cutter the same.
And the stories fly directly in the face of what Wells Fargo has said, which is that it fired anyone involved in the cheating. End of story. The company has now stopped using individual sales goals, apologized to its customers, and in a statement this week says it doesn't tolerate retaliation. Anastasia Crisman with the National Employment Law Project says the bankers who were subjected to this pressure cooker environment were vulnerable.
They tend to be very low paid.
And low-level bank workers are disproportionately women and people of color. Claudia Ponce de Leon says after Wells Fargo fired her, she lost her home, her savings. Now she's 39 and basically starting over. But since all this attention has been on Wells Fargo, she says one thing has gotten better.
Finally, you know, people believe me. Just having the truth come out, I think more than anything, it's just relief.
It's a relief, yes, but it comes a little late. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
You can blame social media for many, many hours of wasted time. But with that wasted time last month came a rise in voter registration. After Facebook added a short message encouraging its users to register, numbers were up across the country, which leads to this question. What difference might that make come November the 8th? Gigi Duban is on that one.
The heated debates, the harsh words, the unfriending. If you've talked politics on Facebook, you've experienced this. But here's where it works really well. For 4 days, the social media giant had a Register Now button that sent users to a federal voter registration site. And states couldn't be happier.
All went extremely well.
That's Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill. Alabama was one of several states, including Minnesota and California, that saw big results. Merrill says almost 40,000 people registered to vote through Facebook.
It's a very effective way to get a word out to a lot of people in a short period of time.
Facebook also adds that social pressure that comes when your friends have signed up to vote and you haven't.
It's called shaming, basically, which is a little horrifying, but it does actually work.
Jim Gilliam is founder and CEO of Nation Builder, which makes software for political campaigns. He says even though women and younger people tend to use Facebook more, its reach is getting wider.
It definitely is going to be skewing less and less over time because, you know, literally everybody is on it.
Now, a lot of people feel guilty about time spent on Facebook. But Kevin Esterling, political science professor at UC Riverside, says registering to vote, that's different.
I mean, it obviously increases goodwill towards the platform.
Oh, and it also gives Facebook more demographic info on its users, which helps it better target ads. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, lousy start, less lousy finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're out with the latest edition of our Marketplace Edison Research poll today, our year-long effort to track how Americans are feeling about the economy, both big picture and in their own lives, as Election Day draws ever closer. Larry Rosen is the president of Edison Research, our partners on this project. Larry, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai.
Let me just run down a couple items here from the survey. So 30% of people full or part-time employed say they fear losing their job. That's opposed to 15% a year ago. 38% who rent a home fear not being able to pay their rent compared to 25% a year ago. These are sort of fundamental issues.
Right. And it really speaks to, I think, the generalized anxiety that exists around this election. Mm-hmm. I think we'll really know if it was the election, if these things subside after the election, no matter who is elected. Is it just the mere fact that we're deciding again who's going to be our leader leads to this anxiety, or is this something more generalized going on?
Right. And they're clearly not feeling it, you know, even apart from those other numbers. 37% of Americans say their personal financial situation is better than a year ago, translated to mean 60-something percent actually don't.
Right. While the statistics say things are getting better, there's just not a lot of on-the-ground evidence that people are feeling it. And that's what these surveys have really shown consistently.
They are also showing in this round specifically that people believe by a 62% majority, 62% of Americans think the economic system is rigged in favor of certain groups. That's actually down from the last time we did this, but it's still really high.
Yes. But one thing we did this time is try to dig more deeply into for whom is it rigged? And we got a ton of really interesting results. Basically, there are certain groups that virtually the entire U.S. population who thinks the economic system is rigged think it's rigged for. 91% of those people say things are rigged for the rich. Mm-hmm. 89%, interestingly, believe that the economy is rigged for politicians. Politicians are rigging the system for themselves, perhaps. And 86% said for corporations. But when you drill more narrowly into the numbers, it gets even more interesting.
Well, so, yeah, so let's break those out by Trump and Clinton voters, right? Because that's what we asked this time.
Right. So this time we are able to look at people who intend to vote for Donald Trump and people who intend to vote for Hillary Clinton. And by the way, people who intend to vote for Clinton are actually a little more likely to believe that the economy is rigged than people who intend to vote for Trump, both very high, but Clinton voters even higher. But they really disagree on a lot of who are the beneficiaries of this kind of rigging. For instance, 62% of Clinton supporters say the economy is rigged for white people, where only 21% of Trump supporters say so. Huh. And counter to that, 56% of Trump supporters say the economy is rigged to benefit minorities compared to only 19% of Clinton supporters. So race is clearly some kind of factor in these perceptions. The other big one is 63% of Trump supporters say the economy is rigged to benefit immigrants compared to 19% of Clinton supporters.
One more thing on this, and I guess it's a little tangential, but it's worth touching on, and then I'll let you go. A quarter of Americans completely distrust the economic data reported by the government. That's stuff that we do on this program all the time. The unemployment rate, number of jobs added, the amount of consumer spending. And that, too, probably not surprisingly, breaks down on partisan lines.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the most astonishing things we've found in any of these surveys. And so we asked people, do they completely trust, somewhat distrust, or completely distrust the economic statistics that are reported by the government? And a quarter of people said that they completely distrust this data. And that's already as eyebrow-raising as it goes, but it really did split. People who intend to support Donald Trump in November, 48% of them said that they completely distrust economic data from the government, as compared to only 5% of Clinton supporters. But that also really means to me, Kai, that no matter who wins the election, this is going to be a problem for them. And so that breakdown in trust, and you know, seemingly from things that are unbiased and apolitical, really creates challenges for the entire system, the media, the government, pretty much everybody.
Larry Rosen, our partners at Edison Research with the latest version. Out today, it's on our website, of the Marketplace Edison Research Economic Survey. Larry, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Also on our website, by the way, our Economic Anxiety Index. Check it out. Take our quiz. See where you fall, how you compare. Marketplace.org. Let's take a quick break from American politics here for a couple of 3 minutes and have a look at Spain. Two inconclusive elections there in the past year have resulted in political stalemate, although the economy does seem to be persevering, especially the hospitality industry over there. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
It's nearly lunchtime and business is brisk in one of Madrid's many bars. La Conserva is a relatively new bar, co-owned by Jorge Iglesias and his wife.
We opened the bar last March, but why opening the bar? Well, we thought it was a good opportunity with the economic recovery. Spain has always been a country to get together with your friends, with your family. I'm not saying that it's incredibly good now because we still have an incredibly high unemployment rate, but it's certainly looking better.
The jobless rate is now at 20%. Still high, but better than the 27% it soared to during the country's recession. Spain hasn't had a permanent government in place since December, but despite the political stalemate, the economic recovery has continued. It's quite visible here on Gran Vía, the big street in central Madrid, where much of the city's commercial and retail activity is based. Now, a few years ago, in the depths of Spain's double-dip recession, many shops and offices in central Madrid were empty and boarded up. That's quite a rare sight now, and many new businesses, including places to eat and drink, are springing up. Asís González is head of Spanish and Portuguese retail analytics for Nielsen. He says Spain's food and drink industry is mounting a comeback.
Well, the last 7 years until 2015, were bad for the bars. And in 7 years, 25,000 bars were closed. But last year, it started again to open bars. It is not a big number of openings. It's only 1%. But the trend has really changed or turned around in the last year.
Spain has an estimated 260,000 bars and restaurants, the most per capita in the world. And Asís González says they can tell us a lot about the country.
Bars and restaurants, they are a good index to know how healthy the economy in a country like Spain is. Bars are in our DNA. So the Spanish people, when they have more money, they like to spend it in bars. So we go out and have a drink, have something to eat. And it is natural, and we do it since we are kids until we are old.
When you're drinking a glass of La Rioja wine or eating a plate of jamón serrano, it's easy to forget about Spain's political crisis. But if it continues, the economy could start to suffer. At the end of October, the deadline will be up for Spain's political parties to reach an agreement and form a new government. If they don't, there'll be yet another general election. Bar owners and their customers alike are hoping it won't come to that.
The BBC's Guy Hedgeko pulling the hard duty in Madrid. Coming up.
We know, and it, not just our state, but across the country, there's not enough funding to do all the projects.
Never is. Never, ever is. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 45 points today, about 0.25%, 18,098 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 25 points, about 0.5%, 5213. The S&P 500 lost 6 points, 0.3%, 2132. The stronger labor market could mean a bigger holiday for some workers. Amazon says it's looking to boost holiday hiring by 20% this year to 120,000 temporary employees. That is going to cost the company. Amazon shares down 0.5% today. Amazon's optimism didn't scare Walmart. It rose 1.1%. We told you about Wells Fargo. Shares down 1.25% today. Chase declined 0.5%. PNC Financial off 2.1%. Earnings for them tomorrow. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. As of today, the recall of those Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phones that burned and exploded also officially covers replacement Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phones that burned and exploded. But if you go talk to battery experts about this, they will tell you that the moral of this story has nothing to do with any one company. There's a big race on right now for thinner, more energy-packed batteries for our phones and computers and cars and planes and power grids. And the harder you push on that, the riskier things can get. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Battery scientists can sound a little nervous when talking about their creations. Chemist Stephen Visco at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab also runs the battery company PolyPlus.
When you started putting more, increasingly more energy in smaller and smaller packages, that's tricky in terms of safety because, you know, it starts to sound like an explosive device, right, which tends to be high-energy, small package.
Now here's Jay Whitaker, material scientist at Carnegie Mellon.
Energy storage is nature's abomination. The more of those lithium ions you have in a very close proximity to each other stored up, the more trouble you could be in. That's a very energetic environment.
Think about it. Energetic environment. Say, dog park. Lots of energy close together. Now imagine bringing in the fences, packing it more tightly. This is inside our sleeker laptops and phones, our smartwatches, electric cars, and our drones. Can't be too thin, right? Here's the issue. Flammable chemicals are packed inside, next to two electrodes that are like fighting dogs. They cannot touch each other. This is where Samsung failed, says Jay Whitaker.
They're reaching a little bit when they make the batteries. Whenever anything new is mass-produced that contains a flammable liquid, you have to, like, cross your fingers a little bit.
Now, it's easy to blame a company here, but we, the customers, contribute to this risk too, says energy investor Matthew Norden.
We've got an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. The unstoppable force is that I want more energy in my phone so it lasts all day. The immovable object is that the more energy I put into these thin layers, the more likely it is that my phone is going to blow up on an airplane.
At this point, let's note these events are extremely rare. You are way more likely to burn up from a lightning strike than a dodgy phone. Still, occasional battery fires and explosions have occurred in planes, electric cars, even power grid facilities.
You want price, performance, and safety? You get to pick two.
The problems have come with today's first-generation lithium-ion batteries that we've been using for three decades now. Billions of dollars are chasing innovation. Now, a safer battery is very hard, and it's very lucrative, says Stephen Visco.
Batteries are, in a sense, becoming the new oil.
So long as they can harness their energy. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There are some policy areas on which Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton do, in fact, agree. We talked about one of them the other day, the carried interest loophole, tax policy. Here with another, infrastructure. Secretary Clinton wants to spend as much as $275 billion over the next 5 years. Mr. Trump has called for spending $1 trillion or more. States, however, are done waiting around for the federal government to get its act together on roads and public transportation and water towers. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story.
Washington, D.C. gridlock, the traffic kind of gridlock, extends far into the suburbs. To ease some of it, there's a multi-million dollar project to extend some express lanes on I-95.
And right around here at this point that we're standing, it's going to then split into two legs.
Paul Nishimoto is the project manager for the effort. He's with the Virginia Department of Transportation. Rather than come up with all the money for this project, VDOT is partnering with a private company. They split the cost, and the private side gets to keep the toll money the lanes will eventually collect.
So when we do these public-private partnerships, do we have the benefit of the private funding being put into the initial capital costs to fund the project? So this just helps us to progress projects at a much faster rate.
These partnerships are one of several strategies states are using to pay for infrastructure. Congressional earmarks to fund big projects are a thing of the past, have been for years now, and there's just not enough money coming from the feds to pay for the country's roads and sewers.
States and local governments are in a bind.
Karen Kuhn studies infrastructure funding at West Virginia University. She says states and local communities only have a few tools to scrounge together money for projects.
So the state initiatives have been primarily where revenues come from either gas taxes or DMV or vehicle sales tax. But you can only raise gas taxes and DMV fees so much.
So they turn to public-private partnerships like the one in Virginia, or ballot measures to raise other taxes. Several of those are coming up across the country in November. That's because there's a massive amount of work that needs doing to fix American infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers says we need $3.6 trillion worth.
Which is about, give or take, the annual federal budget.
In fiscal year 2016, the country spent $3.9 trillion.
So if we didn't spend any federal money on anything else, we could bring our infrastructure up to where it needed to be. Nothing. No Social Security, no Medicare, no Medicaid, no defense, no nothing. We could cover it.
Facing that reality, Virginia and other states aren't waiting by the phone for Washington to call with cash.
We know, not just our state, but across the country, there's not enough funding to do all the projects.
Aubrey Lane is Virginia's Secretary of Transportation. He says the shortage of federal funds forces states to be more creative and careful with spending. And the projects that do get approved tend to be fully funded from the start. So no embarrassing bridges to nowhere.
What's that result? It has been probably less projects, but actually more benefits and more projects getting done that our citizens can reap the benefits from a transportation perspective.
He's encouraged by the presidential candidate's talk of more infrastructure investment, but he's not betting any roads on it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out today, in which things go from bad to worse for Yahoo, Verizon's general counsel. And you should remember here that Verizon is currently evaluating a deal in which it's going to pay $4.83 billion American dollars for Yahoo. He said the company has, quote, reasonable basis, end of quote, to believe that the ginormous Yahoo email breach of a couple of weeks ago is enough to let Verizon back out of that deal. Serious question here. What happens to Yahoo if that happens? I mean, I know what happens, right? You can see the price going way down, but still, who's going to look at Yahoo and say, sure. All right, anyway, the Dow off 45 points today, 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 25 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 6 points, 0.3%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.